Well, I'm glad you're back here for session 14 on making and preaching sermons. I hope that video by Jim Cimbala was helpful to you in understanding a little bit of one style of a kind of nouthateo sermon, an admonishment kind of sermon. And when you start thinking about your own preaching schedule, whether you preach regularly or if you're a guest occasionally in a place or whether you travel around, occasionally God may have that kind of message for your people. And at that time, you need to be responsive to his leading and preach a nouthateo sermon. However that turns out and whatever the issues are, there are many, many issues in Scripture that confront the culture in which we live, confront the church in the time in which we are serving. And so nouthateo is an important one. Well, we've got one more kind of sermon, style of sermon, and I've saved this one to last because this one really doesn't have a word in Scripture that describes it. And what I'm talking about right now is the story sermon, or what sometimes is called narrative preaching. Now, there's not a word that describes this in Scripture, but much of the preaching of Jesus was done this way. And we'll get into that in a few moments. But what I want to reflect on first is the power of this kind of story sermon or narrative preaching. The picture that you see up here was a man who was a leader. He was an elder in the church that I first served many, many years ago. In fact, I was called to that church in 1979 and served there for 4.5 years. Now, this man, Jim, this is, again, a picture from his obituary. He was dying when he contacted me and my wife and others. He had struggled with cancer under various treatments for several years and decided that as he was told there was nothing else they could do, that he wanted to celebrate life. And they wanted to celebrate their life together. And so they invited anybody who had had influence on them over their lifetime together. Now, this man has an interesting conversion story in the sense that he was a farmer. He lived with a wife who was a believer and attended the church I was pastoring. And he would come occasionally, but it was always kind of to sleep, basically. He was a farmer by kind of avocation. That's what he loved to do. He worked in a factory as well. But one Sunday morning, he got up to go to church, and it was harvest time, and he looked out, and there were clouds, and he said, "It looks like it's going to rain. I'm not going to church. I'm going to my field. I'm going to try to get the harvest in." I think it was a corn harvest that he was working on. And he took the tractor out to his field, and it started pouring, so much so that he couldn't get the tractor out because it was getting stuck in the mud. And so instead of getting the crop in, he went to the local restaurant where farmers gather and complained about things to each other. And that's where he sat there and went in and said, "You know what? Wasn't that a rainstorm?" And people looked at him like, "What?" And he found out as he looked at, talked to all of his neighbors around, that his was the only field that got rained on. And so he said, he looked up to God and he said, "Oh, God, okay, I get the message." And he had a conversion experience that allowed him to deal with his alcoholism and et cetera. Anyway, this man is now inviting us to a celebration of his life. And we went there and we hadn't seen many of these people for over 30 years. And it was a delightful time to remember that time when I was their pastor with some of them and, you know, some of the things that we got to see God do together. And then as I was leaving, knowing that I'm never going to see him again, I gave him a hug. And I said, "Jim, you know what? You were just good for me as a young pastor. You know, I started there when I was 25 years old. As a young pastor, you just really helped me." And he said, "Well," he said, "I got to tell you." He said, "You know, this is a time of a lot of memory for me." And he said, I will never forget." He said, "You standing up there and becoming a Bible character." Now, that was shocking to me. Because I only did that a handful of times during that time. I preached over 400 sermons in that church because we had two services, morning and evening, different sermon in each of them. And yet what he remembered, what had power for him, was those times I became a Bible character. Because occasionally during the high holidays, like Christmas, Advent, and Easter, for special services, I would indeed become a story that I would tell to people. And it was so powerful for him that he could name some of those people that I'd become. I became a shepherd, I became a Herod, I became Simeon, I became a variety of people. And he remembered words that I said. He remembered images that I used. And that's kind of the power in this day and age of the story of narrative or narrative kind of preaching. that it's something that taps into people who are media savvy and media soaked in our world today, many of our people. And so telling the story allows them to check in a different way. Here's how Brian Chappell put it. Brian Chappell was president of the Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri, and he was also a professor of preaching there. But in his book, Christ-Centered Preaching, he said, narrative preaching is built on the idea that oral communication is not usually heard as logical points, but rather as a flow of impressions that are built or turned through the various moves of language. Let's break down that a little bit, because that becomes kind of a definition for story preaching. It's oral communication. Now, before, the printing press was invented, people passed on their history and passed on their stories by oral communication. And there's a flow to those stories. And so it's not a set of logical points. Now, in my Western mind, in other words, I was educated with a Western type of education, I'm taught to think logically and to move linearly from this point to this point to this point. And indeed, a lot of my sermons are that way. But this kind of a story sermon rather looks at a flow of impressions. In other words, it's more connected to the emotions. It's movements of a story. Now, there are two different ways story sermons, I think, or narrative preaching can be used effectively. One is Bible stories come alive. And two, a story that relates biblical truth but is not a Bible story. I'm going to give you some examples of each of them over the next couple of years, next couple of sessions. But today, what I want you to just look at is, first of all, what it means to construct this kind of sermon. Now, I'm very much indebted to Dr. Pablo Jimenez. You'll notice that there he was invited to Gordon Conwell Seminary and Wesleyan University and Seminary as an adjunct professor. He's been adjunct at many places. He's a professor in Puerto Rico and has received training there. And he does a whole class on narrative preaching. And I'm just going to choose some highlights of what he said about narrative preaching. First of all, it has the following characteristics. It guides the imaging our listeners do. The more you can create pictures in people's minds, the more effective it's going to be. And then it gives a contemporary appeal to the biblical tradition. In other words, I am telling the story, especially if it's just a narrative sermon that's not biblically based, I'm telling a story that taps into the values of Scripture, and I let you know them. It helps the hearers to identify with the meaning of the stories. Now, one of the ways he says you should do this is to follow kind of the saga form. He talks about different forms, but it's a short story that there's a setting that's set out, and then there's a plot that can be divided into episodes. There's a climax to the story, and then there's a resolution. So that's the story plan that if you're writing a novel, that's usually what you do, and you can follow that in the novels that you read. And then he says, and the numbers here don't mean anything because I've picked and chosen out of his slides, identify the characters, the main character. Who is that? Fully develop that character. There may be more than one. There are secondary characters. There are people who play a secondary role to what you're saying at that time. For instance, Jesus talking about the woman who's putting in the two mites, right? The character of that story is that woman. Now, the secondary characters are all the other people who are dropping in their offerings and they're making a bold gesture, but they're secondary to the focus on this woman. And then there are some people who might be types, and that's what this woman becomes. She becomes a type who represents a larger group of people who are willing to give everything to God, trusting Him that much. And then there are shadows. There are people like the multitudes that are standing by, the ones at the story of the crucifixion, or the ones who are crying, "Crucify Him! Crucify Him!" They're secondary. They're shadowy figures. They're not the ones we really focus on, because we're focused on Jesus, and we're focused on the drama of Him and the religious leaders and the Romans, etc. So think about your characters. Develop them well. Know the background. Study the social, political, and historical background of the biblical text. And don't be discouraged by this task. Remember that this kind of research has a cumulative effect. In other words, the more you fill your story with details, the more connecting it will be. Fourth, know the literary context. Be aware of the events that immediately precede and follow your story. Remember that most New Testament stories use Old Testament stories as subtext. In other words, when you're telling the story, you can jump beyond the the logical time-based story that you're telling to talk about effects. But you've got to be aware of what happened afterwards if you're going to do that effectively. Fifth, know the geography. Study the geography of the places. A good biblical atlas will help you in achieve good handling of these details, and consider the possibility of taking a tax-deductible trip to Israel. Don't know if those trips are still tax-deductible here in the U.S., but you know, if you've been to Israel, you have a whole area that you can describe. You can describe the temple area well because of what you see there. You can describe the flow of people through Jerusalem, etc. So know the geography. Appeal to the senses. We're going to talk about this later as we talk about creating pictures, but the more you can talk about colors and odors and textures, these make your story vivid and living for the people. And then you memorize it. You work hard to memorize it. And he describes these kind of people. Read the story several times. Find the main sections. In other words, the setting, plot, climax, resolution. Divide the episodes. Identify each section with a key word and write out a short outline of key words. And then memorize that outline. And practice, 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 practice. Basically, that's how it goes. Now, if you are going to tell not just a Bible story, but one relating biblical truth, you've got to, one, be clear about your point. This is not Dr. Jimenez now. This is me. Be clear about your point. Because if you're telling stories that aren't in Scripture, it's got to be clear exactly how you express the truth. Now, you can make that connection for them, or you can let people figure it out. Jesus often, when he told parables, like the parable of the sower, you know, he tells this wonderful story, and the people are kind of left saying, what did that mean? Disciples come to Jesus and say, what did that mean? And you find that happening often with Jesus' parables. And in fact, the disciples say, why do you continue to preach in parables? And Jesus says, well, so that hearing, some won't hear. They won't be able to figure it out. It's got to be something that's inspired by the Spirit. And so however you choose to do that, just make sure you do it well. In other words, they've got to know your point. There've got to be certain points to the story, not just a nice story. If you read just a nice story, people will come to the end and say, what in the world was that about? I find that with novels that I read. I read a novel in the recent past that at the end I thought, okay, so what? There wasn't a tension built to a climax, and there wasn't a resolution to the issues that were raised. It was just kind of there. The more you can make the story makes a point, the better off you are. Now, I'm going to give you an example of that with a story by Rob Bell. Now, that's not a good name right now in the Christian world. Rob Bell was a very influential pastor of a megachurch here in West Michigan, and he began to theologically kind of go off the rails. But before he did some marvelous work as a storyteller. He did a series of Bible studies, and I'm going to show you just one of those Bible studies where he told stories. And then he applied those stories in a creative way. Now, you know, he's got advantages in that he's got film going for him. He's got a crew of people filming him. He's got people editing those. And he can act out the story as he tells the story because he's got this film crew filming him and that sort of thing. He's got those advantages. But what I want you to note with him is he's an excellent storyteller. And the points that he's making are powerful points. I first saw this video years ago, and when I was putting this together, this lecture on a story sermon, it's one of the first things I thought of, again, the power of a story. And so I share it with you. It's about 10 minutes long. Enjoy, and we'll come back next time to continue the study of the narrative or story sermon. Thank you.
couple years ago, I was with my family, and we were spending some time in this cabin in the woods on the edge of this remote lake. I mean, we were deep in the middle of nowhere. And one morning, my son Trace and I, we woke up and set out to take a walk around the lake. It was one of those mornings, like not a cloud in the sky. And as the birds are singing, and my son Trace, he's about a little over a year old at the time. And so he's making all these little chirps and squawks that one-year-old boys make. And I had him in one of those hiking backpacks where he rode back here. So as I walk along, I can hear him making all his noises. And so we head out through the woods to walk around the lake. And it's just one of those, you ever had those moments, like, if you could just freeze them? It's just so beautiful. And we get to the other side of the lake, and we're exactly at the halfway point. We're the farthest possible point from the cabin, and we're rounding the bend to head back, and I look up and I notice clouds. And then it starts to rain. It always rains, doesn't it? It's interesting, because the scriptures say all sorts of things about rain and storms. When Jesus is teaching about what it means to live like the fullness of life in his kingdom, when Jesus speaks of it, he speaks of two different people. He speaks of a person who builds their house on sand, someone who chooses to reject his teachings, and someone who builds their life, their house on rock, who chooses to build their life on Jesus' teachings. And then the metaphor he uses is that of a storm that comes, and the person who rejects his teachings and his truth, essentially the house built on sand just gets destroyed, but the house that's built on rock stands. So this idea, Jesus says, when the rains come, it's not like they might, they do. It rains in our lives a lot. At first, there's a drop here and a drop there, and so I put Trace's hood over his head. But what I didn't know was that he pulled it off. And so gradually, the drops, they get bigger and bigger, and they fall faster and faster. And in no time, it is pouring. I mean, the kind of rain that just soaks, it plasters your hair against your head, and the kind that just drenches your clothing. And at first, Trace, the thunder and the lightning, he's okay, but as it picks up and it gets louder and louder and the wind becomes more intense and the trees start to shake, Trace becomes more and more agitated. I can feel him, like, on my back. And at first he starts to whimper, and then he lets out kind of a little shout here and there, but in no time, Trace is shrieking at the top of his lungs. I mean, the wind is blowing, it's thunder and lightning, and we are just getting plastered with this heavy rain, and the trees are no longer providing any shelter. And Trace, just from like deep in his being, starts to yell and cry so loudly and with such passion and terror in his voice. It's interesting, because if you think like the word cry and you search the scriptures, you find this word comes up over and over again. Like even the book of Psalms, just the book of Psalms, if you're like to start reading through, it speaks over and over and over again of crying out to God. And God says these amazing things, like he says, when you cry out to me, I listen. He even says, I cannot ignore the cry of somebody who's afflicted. It's like if I'm hurting, lost, soaking wet, scared, confused, God says, you cry out and I hear. God even says that when you cry, he's close to the brokenhearted. He's close to those who cry out and admit they're scared, lost, soaking wet, and confused. See, there is this false, twisted idea out there among religious people that somehow you got to have it all together to have a relationship with God. That like somehow God's only looking for people who have no problems and have it all nailed down and can put on like the happy face all the time. And yet the scriptures speak directly against this kind of thinking. I mean, Jesus is even just straight ahead and he says, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden. I mean, the essence of salvation is crying out to God and admitting, I don't have it all together. It's admitting, I am lost, I am hurting, and this sinful nature that I carry around with me has really screwed things up for me. And God, if you don't show me the way home, if you don't fix things, if you don't step in, I am dying here. And this church, this kind of thinking is all throughout the scriptures. It's over and over again, God says to us, when you come to me, you come to me with all your junk. Come to me with your problems. Come to me all screwed up, all messed up. Let me take care of it. Jesus even sets out looking for people. He even says this. He says, I'm not looking for the healthy. I came for the sick. It's interesting if you think about the storm from Trace's perspective. For Trace, the storm is his reality. He sees nothing else. The lightning and the thunder and the trees swaying and the raindrops and the water just dripping off him. It's all he knows. He sees no reality beyond this storm. What Trace doesn't realize is that as his dad, I would do anything to get him home. So at this point, Trace is shrieking at the top of his lungs in stereo right behind my head. And I stop and I kneel down and I take him out of the pack and I pull him close to my chest and I wrap my arms around him and I hold him so tightly up against my heart. And for the last mile of our walk, the entire time I bend over and I whisper into his ear over and over again, I love you, buddy. We're gonna make it. Dad knows the way home. We're gonna make it. I love you, buddy. And over and over and over again, through the storm, I carry him home, clutched tightly against my chest, whispering, I love you, buddy. We're gonna make it. Now imagine if, like, years later, Trace is in therapy or something, and he drags up this repressed memory of the walk. And he comes to me and he's like, Dad, what'd you let me go through that for? I got all this junk inside me. I thought you loved me. How could you have exposed me to something that horrible, that storm? I mean, why didn't you protect me? I would be crushed. Because for me, that walk was one of my deepest, most intimate memories of my life with my son. I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. Maybe you're bitter or you got all this anger inside because of some things you've been through, some storms in your life. You're wondering if he really loved me, if God really was there, he wouldn't have let me go through that. Maybe God is saying, no, Sam, don't you understand? I got to hold you tight. I got to remind you over and over again. I love you, buddy. As it says in the scriptures, the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 1, God's reminding his people of how good he's been to them. He says, remember, I carried you like a father carries a son. And now, may you, when you're soaking wet, lost, hurting, and confused, may you cry out, and may the creator of the universe take you out of your pack. May he hold you tight up against his chest. May he wrap his eternal loving arms around you, and may you hear him whisper, I love you, buddy.